here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses.
Game over, man. It's game over.
How's everybody doing, philosopher kings and queens? Working class heroes, happy new year, hopefully. It's really hard to say that kind of stuff, given the state of the world. I mean, outside of the fact that there are, you know, close to 100,000 dead in Asia because of these tsunamis and this. It's just, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around it. There are tornadoes in Los Angeles and Sedona, Arizona. You know, if I was a religious person, I would think that we are on the cusp of something more awful than that. You know, I almost half expected Bush to come out and make a statement yesterday saying, I am the Antichrist, the time is now. But, you know, that didn't happen, you know, and he was a little, a little late on his statement, though he was providing some support in creating an international coalition, saying that they will be working with Australia and a couple other countries and to help out. It seems to me that he was still defensive about criticism of him not showing up earlier. And I'm still hung up, you know, about yesterday or the day before yesterday. On Tuesday, actually, President Bill Clinton said, quote, it's really important that somebody takes the lead in this, because he was in England. It was going on. It was unfolding news. He is an ex-president. He is Bill Clinton. He is a diplomat and a representative of this country. And he was concerned, and he was showing his concern and his empathy. And, of course, the Bush administration immediately got defensive. You know, Clinton's remarks caused displeasure at the White House, according to the Washington Post. The newspaper said Bush aides criticized the former president for being too quick to get in front of the cameras. I don't know if that's, that's reasonable. I mean, they, you know, theoretically, Bush should have been on the TV on Monday, on Sunday, after, right when they heard this thing. You know, I mean, Bush's criticism of Clinton is ridiculous. You know, a Bush aide said that actions speak louder than words, all right? And this is the one that kills me. Quote, the president wanted to be fully briefed on our efforts. He didn't want to make a symbolic statement about, you know, quote unquote, we feel your pain, a White House official told the newspaper. Why not? Why not the leader of the free world get on TV and say, we do feel your pain and we're going to do everything we can to help out in this effort? I mean, this thing is horrible, to the point where it's like I feel guilty, you know, waking up in the morning and having breakfast, for Christ's sake. I mean, I woke up this morning, I'm like, how the hell can you go through your day knowing that there's this much pain and grief in the world, let alone, you know, the 1,300 plus soldiers that have been killed in Iraq and the hundreds of thousands of civilians injured and dead in Iraq. It's mind blowing to me that, you know, that this stuff is so far away, and then I can get up in the morning and go, oh, I wonder if I'm going to have oatmeal. Oh, look, there's my cats. But on some level, you know, the New Year's coming up, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, what kind of changes am I going to make? You know, what can I do that's different? You know, and my wife's in town, and there are some things on some level on an individual basis. You just have to be, grateful for what you have, and you have to treat people as best you can, and you got to do whatever you can do to help out people that need help. You know what I mean, Chris? I'm all alone here because Riley's on vacation, and I've rarely been on the mic by myself, and it's sort of interesting because I'm like, I've all of a sudden realized I was out there, I'm talking to the world, Chris, and then I'm looking at the back of your head, and I'm like, wait a minute, Kalo's right there. What about you?
It's nice, man. It's nice hearing you say that because, I feel the same way.
Yeah,
you
know? It's like it's weird, and I feel guilty because I'm reading this piece today, you know, in the New York Times, outside of my, you know, hostility against Bush and the paltry $35 million. It's paltry. You know, that the fact that this administration got defensive about the amount of money they were kicking in, they should be defensive because it's nothing. $15 million, which is what they said on Monday, is an insult.
Yep.
$35 million is still an insult. It really is. You know, according to a poll, most Americans believe the United States spends 25% of its budget on aid to poor countries. It actually spends well under a quarter of 1%. Okay. It's unbelievable. And, you know, and Colin Powell was mad. You know, he was about the charges of stinginess. And he pointed to disaster relief and said the United States, quote, has given more aid in the last 4 years than any other nation or combination of nations in the world.
end quote. But for development aid, America gave $16.2 billion in 2003. The European Union gave $37.1 billion. In 2002, these numbers were $13.2 billion for America and $29.9 billion for Europe. We are the richest country in the world. And we can't, you know, first of all, there's 45 million people uninsured in this country. There's a, you know, poverty is on the rise. We can barely help our own country, yet there's still, this is the wealthiest country in the world. And the globe is, you know, the entire planet is in crisis. I mean, literally, the entire planet shifted its axis. That's how bad this thing was, Chris. Unbelievable. Right. Shifted its axis. You know, what's interesting to me, though?
What's that?
Is that, you know, I get up, I'm reading this Frank Rich piece, you know, and he is talking about the big, the Kennedy Center honors.
Okay.
You know, which apparently was taped. It's a, you know, it's a variety show. It's when Washington sort of, you know, kind of mingles with Hollywood. They give out a few awards. There's a few performances. You know, Elton John was awarded. But, you know, he makes a point that, you know, with the war going on and with the, there were things, it was apparently taped on December, it was taped, you know, a few days ago. It was taped on, December 5th, okay? And that day, the morning newspaper is told of, you know, there were deadly strikes by suicide bombers in Mosul and Baghdad, killing at least 26 Iraqi security officers, you know, and 8 people in a police station. Yet, this guy, Frank Rich, writes about watching it and seeing no indication at all that anything is wrong in the world.
Huh.
You know, and it, but it's true, though. It's weird in this country how we get so, you know, there's so much stimuli, there is so much, distractions, so much shiny things, that it's very easy to think that everything is sort of a minor problem, as long as, you know, you're dealing with your own life. You know, and the thought right now, if I just try and, you know, even for a moment, take on the pain and grief in the world, for, you know, because of this thing, I don't even know how to handle it. I'm just grateful that, you know, that we do have somebody coming, and we have Shawn Bowen. She's a spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society. She's going to talk to us from Geneva about, you know, how aid is dispersed, what is really going on, what, you know, what any of us can really do. I know that if you go to morningsedition.com, there are links that should lead you to, you know, to at least make a donation. It is up to us on some level. If our government is only going to give $35 million right now in its initial sort of investment, not investment, but its initial charitable donation to help rebuild things, and I guess we're sending 12 vessels and an aircraft carrier, but it's mind-blowing to me because the upcoming inauguration is going to cost $50 million, all right?
What?
$50 million for 3 days of events. That's inaugurating a president that's already in office, $50 million. Think about how amazing it would be if George W. Bush just got on TV and said, look, you know what, we're not going to make a big deal out of this because there's a lot of things going on that need attention. And the $50 million that usually goes into me, you know, getting, you know, new weird uniforms made that make me look like the commander of the universe, and, you know, for me to get my, you know, my wife dressed properly and my, you know, kids together and security and all my friends and all this fluff and pomp and circumstance, you know, for a guy that most of us don't like. You know, for him, why can't he get on TV and just say, you look, you know what, we're just going to have dinner, you know, with friends and maybe have someone videotape it. We'll put it on TV. But we're going to send the $50 million to help rebuild, you know, what needs rebuilding in any number of countries that have been hit by this thing.
That would be a really stand-up thing for him to do.
It would be amazing, but it would be, you know, it would be completely out of character because the arrogance of this guy, the first response of this administration when Clinton says, you know, somebody should take the lead in this is to attack Clinton. Right? This is like there is 100,000 people almost dead. The first response of the Bush administration is like, hey, who the hell does that guy think he is? It's unbelievable to me. Yeah. Well, that's what I think. And here's the thing. The other thing is the Republican National Convention in New York City cost $58 million just for security. And the Iraq War cost U.S. taxpayers $177 million per day. This is a war that most people.
I'm sorry. Per day?
$177 million per day.
Wow.
And they're not even getting the equipment that the guys need over there. And most of the people in this country think this is the wrong war at the wrong time. Most people are losing faith in our ability to handle this thing properly or to ever get out of Iraq. $177 million a day. Maybe they should take that money, stop killing Iraqi civilians, and put a little of it into helping out where 100,000 people were killed by, you know, by natural disaster. Here's it, you know, on the animal note, you know, maybe I can tie this up with a little animal note before we go off to break, is apparently they have found no bodies of animals. There's no animals are dying in this tsunami. You know why? Because animals know. They know. They know it's coming. And I believe that at one time, human beings knew this stuff, too. We've just become so distracted, so mediated, that, you know, we can't... I'm not blaming victims, obviously, but it's a very ironic and weird thing that not one animal corpse has been found amidst all this this horrendous catastrophe, because the animals, apparently, they have a sense, you know? My cats are acting strange. You know,
really?
Yesterday, yeah.
How so?
Yeah, 2 days ago. I don't know. They must have known about this thing. My wife's in town, Chris. I'm going to shift gears here. And for some reason, some of the cats, this is really, really pissing me off.
What's that?
Can't believe I'm making this transition, but I am. They like her. They're two of them. I'm sitting there with these cats that hate me, and one of them is literally climbing on my wife. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? I've been with these cats 6 months. How long has it been?
It's been a while.
I can't even get that one to touch me. It's sitting on my wife's lap. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I go across the street to the guy, the Yemeni guy that I gave Meanie to, you know, to get rid of the cat so it would have a better life at least, and have the life of a wild animal.
Please
mousing.
Don't tell me that he cuddles up to that cat.
No, worse. He said his brother came over. You know, he had her in the basement, you know.
Uh-huh.
She didn't like him either. But his brother came over and fed her out of his hand, then picked her up and took her to Brooklyn. Picked her up?
Wow.
Picked that cat up? Oh, man. Too weird. Too awkward a situation. Too awkward a transition, maybe. But it's 17 past the hour. I'm going to get a little more into what's going on in Asia around the tsunami as we lead up to our guest, Sean Bowen, who is a spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross. It's 17 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mike Mills from REM, and you are listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. I am Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My pal, my co-host, Mark Riley, is away still in England. Quite a vacation Mr. Riley is taking. Got no problem with it. I hope he's having a good time. But I'm just hanging out here with the fellas. Got Kalo on the board. Got Kent the Colonel Jones will be in later. We'll talk about some movies. Got P.W. McDonald. He's going to come in. We're going to do some news. Got Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman. We're going to talk about tort reform and pharmaceutical transgressions. Is that a word I can use? Pharmaceutical crimes, pharmaceutical shenanigans. This is the most evil type of corporation in the planet. These guys know we need the drugs. There's nothing that's going to change that. You know what I mean? That's one of the big things about being alive in the Western world and the modern world is eventually you're going to need the drugs, and they know that. So they're going to try and take every last cent of your retirement money, of your estate money, whatever they can take before you kick it. That's why they're so against the assisted suicide thing, is because they're like, no, what, are you kidding me? I mean, there's still a lot of money to drain out of these dying people. We don't want them to kill themselves. Hey, boy, what a positive show I'm running today. The new year coming up. I was talking about the tsunamis, and I am going to continue talking about them until we talk to Sean Bowen, who is a spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Geneva. She'll be on after the break. But at this time, the UN said there were now like strong grounds to believe that the toll in the Sumatran province of Aceh, the worst affected area, would be as high as 80,000. The number dead has now climbed in every country affected, including Thailand, 1,700 confirmed dead, Indonesia, more than 42,000, India, nearly 7,000, Sri Lanka, 22,500 are confirmed dead. And this is clearly the largest natural disaster in my lifetime, I think most of our lifetimes, and I'm sad to say, as I was saying, okay, well, before Zet, that, you know, because we're over here, because there's distance, because the only way we're taking it in is on television, it's hard to know, you know, what to do, you know, what do we do, how do we react, you know, and I believe that we, you know, you can go to our website at morningsedition.com and find out where you can, you know, make a donation or try and help out. But as I was saying before, with the new year coming up, Kalo, I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, again, what changes, you know, we can make. I guess all we can do is I'm trying to be grateful. I'm trying to, you know, think, what are you thinking about for yourself for the next year?
I'm going to try to stay positive, you know.
Yeah.
Going to just pace myself, you know, with the new, you know, the old president in office. I just want to kind of keep on building up, doing my job and,
yeah.
Doing well. How about you?
Yeah, well, it's weird. There's a double-edged sword with me because I want to experience more gratitude in my life. I want to appreciate, my life more, because you start to realize, wow, it isn't that long of a time.
Yeah.
I want to try and be a better person to other people, be a little less selfish, because I'm sort of a self-centered person, and I guess we all are a bit, but I am sort of self-obsessed to the point of ridiculousness at
really?
Times. A little bit. When I get off the mic and I go out into the world, it's a lot of me going, wow, I wonder if I'm doing okay. I wonder if everything's all right with me. How am I doing? What do I look like? How are these shoes? Are these shoes good? It's ridiculous. But I've been with my wife now for 2 weeks, which is the longest time we've been together in a while. And I'm like, I'm so happy to have somebody in my life. It's crazy.
Tell me about it, yeah.
Aren't you?
Yeah.
Isn't it like the greatest thing at those moments when you're just sitting there with your wife or your girlfriend or your kids or whatever, your dog, whoever you have in your life. I mean, I don't want to judge, the lonely. But, where you're just sort of like, wow, this is really okay. I'm having a pretty good 3 minutes right now.
Yeah, yeah. I get that a lot. I'm like, wow, I can't believe someone actually wants to be with me.
Yeah.
And is happy being with me.
I ask her that all the time. I'm like, are you sure about this?
Yeah.
She's like, no, it's a joke. I've been with you 5 years. I married you. Guess what? I'm about to reveal to you that it's a big joke. No, and then you wonder what happens. You have a good 3 minutes, and all of a sudden something stupid happens, and it's gone.
Nah, that's life, man.
But the double-edged sword is essentially that, as much as I want to have a richer, fuller life, I still want to completely destroy the administration that's ruining our country. I completely want to try to get the progressive agenda moved through the world and enacted in some way. I completely want to continue fighting these bullies and rapers of our economy and everything else. I need to do that. And it's weird. Every day I come to work and I'm like, well, I'm feeling okay today. How am I going to get the hate up? How am I going to find the moxie to get this in my head? It's hard to feel peace of mind at all because on some level we all aspire to peace of mind, but yet another level our agenda is to completely disrupt this false order of things because these guys have robbed us of our democracy. It's a difficult balance to have. It's hard to have a good time. That's why I've been going to a lot of movies lately. And I think I'm going to go to the Museum of Modern Art. Well, are we supposed to go?
We're supposed to. I think Terry, our like head booker.
Are we going to go and do that? Me, Kalo, and Kent the Colonel Jones?
Without a doubt.
We're going to go to the new Museum of Modern Art next week, I think.
Yeah, we're with the curator, yeah.
Okay, so I'm not going to go today with my wife. Maybe I'll just take her out to lunch or something.
Boy, but there are a ton of other museums.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, maybe, good point. Go take in some art and hide the pain for a little while.
There you go.
Coming up, Sean Bowen, spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Geneva, will give us some hard but true facts about what's going on with the aid and what's going on with the horrendous disaster. It's 28 past the hour, Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. I am Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. My comrade Mark Riley is still on vacation in England until he'll be back on Wednesday. Looking forward to Monday. We've got Wayne Gilman. Wayne Gilman's going to be co-hosting on Monday. And I believe on Tuesday, Anthony LaPay from the Guerrilla News Network will be co-hosting with me. Friday, of course, tomorrow we are going to do a best of show. It is New Year's. I'm not a big New Year's Eve kind of guy. I'll talk about that later because now, thank you, Ramon. Goodbye. Nice cowboy hat. George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today. Here's the president's schedule. 8 a.m. Wake up in Crawford. Note, I'm fat, fat, fat. Get on that bike, lard ass. 8:10 a.m. Ride mountain bike hard until sense of panic and shame subside. Or until I fall off. 11 a.m. Make emergency announcement to the world. We must raise more money in this critical time. $50 million for my inauguration will not be enough. Do you know how much buffalo wings cost, huh? 1 p.m., go to coffee shop. Note, make jokes with locals about Asia, throwing a little of that. How about Asia throwing a little bit of that tsunami our way? Gets kind of dry out here. Then tell the one about the black, the Mexican, the Jew, and the rowboat. 3 p.m., respond to AARP attack on my plan to privatize Social Security. Arrest everyone in local Applebee's during early bird special. That'll show them. 5 p.m., prepare for New Year's Eve. Note, Plan to go to bed early. The world expects me to vacation. I can't disappoint them. 7 p.m., resolution for 2005. Yes, resolution for 2005, same different year. A little slow on the beat. That laugh, of course, our associate, or no, he's our editorial producer, Dan Pasman, is going to be joining me for this interview.
Hi.
The biggest relief drive in history is underway for victims of Sunday's tsunami, but with the staggering breadth of the damage, distributing the aid could be difficult. You can, as I said, go to morningsedition.com for links. On our show right now, a spokesperson at the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is on the phone. Sean Bowen, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
What is it going to take, first of all, you know, financially, if, from where you're sitting to deal with this horrendous catastrophe?
Well, we've launched an initial appeal for $59 million U.S. dollars. So that will help us to help people, about 2 million people, over the next 6 to 8 months. But that appeal will probably be revised as we find out more.
$59 million. Now, our president has guaranteed $35 million. Is there some disappointment in that from your organization?
Well, I think we have to look at what is being donated worldwide.
And, yes.
We appreciate all the help that all governments are giving to the international community. But we hope that if the need increases, then governments might also increase their pledges.
What needs to happen right now? And tell me, you know, how many? What is the death toll from where you are right now? And what has to happen immediately?
Well, our official sources tell us that the death toll now stands at just over 84,000.
Oh, my God.
But we are worried that this will increase to around 100,000 as we get more information from areas that haven't been accessed as yet. The immediate need is we've got many teams going in, emergency response teams, to help our national Red Crosses on the ground. We will be distributing the immediate relief that people need, such as food, clean drinking water, shelter, and basically helping them in these first few days to survive this tragedy.
Sean, we're talking with Sean Bowen, spokesperson for the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, who joins us from Geneva. It was an interesting article today about one of the bigger concerns is not only the physical damage that's been done to property and to people, but also the psychological damage of having witnessed this disaster, having lived through it for many people. What types of aid are you guys going to be providing for people trying to cope in the face of this disaster?
Absolutely. The psychological impact on people will be devastating. We specialize in psychological support. Last year when we had the huge earthquake in Bam in Iran, we ran extensive psychological programs, which are still running at this time. So psychological programs run for months, if not years. And we will be looking to do the same thing in this region. It's not something which you do immediately in the first few days, because you're concentrating on your absolute basics, on keeping people alive. But we will be turning our attention to the psychological needs as well. We have specialist teams. We have a specialist center for psychological support in Copenhagen, which developed the latest techniques, and they will be going in to assist. So this is something which we will be gearing up to do. I mean, the national societies will already be providing that support, the local staff and volunteers, but that will be geared up into organized programs over the coming weeks and months.
So how many people do you have, you know, out in, are there areas that have not been, you know, investigated at all yet? I read some reports earlier today that there are some regions that have not even been assessed. Is that true?
I think, yes, that is still the case. We're getting down to more inaccessible areas, like we're getting information out of the Andaman Islands now, down off India, where it is feared that 3,000 might be dead down there. So it is very worrying times, and this tragedy is still unfolding.
Yeah, it's staggering. The death toll is almost beyond human comprehension. And what I want to know was there absolutely no warning? Was there? I mean, how come so many people have died in these regions? Why is that?
Well, I think it was because there was no warning. Everyone was caught unawares, and no one really would have imagined that this sort of tragedy on this scale could happen.
Yeah.
Countries were not geared up for this sort of thing. Countries do have their own national disaster programs, but they would have based that at a lower scale of need. So gearing up to this kind of extensive scale of extensive devastation is going to take time.
Sure.
Would have caught everyone unawares, unfortunately.
Sean, you talk about this extensive devastation. I mean, the sheer magnitude of this disaster seems kind of hard for any of us to wrap our brains around. Is it something that is even overwhelming to some of the veteran aid workers who have seen some of the worst disasters this planet has seen in recent years?
Yeah, I think it will be extremely hard for the aid workers that are out there. We've been talking to our staff on the ground with our local Red Cross and Red Crescent societies, and many of them have lost family members or colleagues or friends. So they're dealing with the situation with also having their own personal loss. So this is a very difficult time for them, and that's why we are sending in so much international support to help these people who will be also having to deal with their own time of grieving, as well as trying to help those who have survived.
Well, Sean Bowen, what can our listeners, what can I do, what can we do from where we are to help in this effort?
What we have done is we have set up a special donation website, which is www.donate.ifrc.org. And people can donate to that. That's donating to the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. And they can select to donate directly to the Asia Appeal on that site. So this is the first time we've had to introduce a dedicated site for donations because we are being overwhelmed on our normal main website. So if people could go to the donate.ifrc.org site and donate, we would be extremely grateful.
Well, Sean, you know, thank you for all the work you're doing. We're certainly going to put that message out to our listeners and get people donating and try to do all we can from this end. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay. That was Sean Bowen, a spokesperson at the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Geneva. If you want to write this down, donate.ifrc.org. We will put it on morningsedition.com as a link. Pretty intense.
Very intense. And, you know, as we just talk about people donating and everyone doing their part, I just, you know, before we go to break, I wanted to bring to people's attention this New York Times editorial that I thought was one of the best editorials I've seen in the New York Times in a long time. The headline is, "Are We Stingy? Yes." And I'll read one quote here. It really struck me. It says, "We hope Colin Powell was privately embarrassed when 2 days into a catastrophic disaster that hit 12 of the world's poorer countries and will cost billions of dollars to ameliorate, he held a press conference to say that America, the world's richest nation, would contribute $15 million. That's less than half of what Republicans plan to spend on the Bush inaugural festivities."
Yeah.
And it says, "The American aid figure for the current disaster is now $35 million, which remains a miserly drop in the bucket, in keeping with the pitiful amount of the United States budget that we allocate for non-military foreign aid."
Yeah, even if you're a narrow-minded conservative idiot who thinks the New York Times is some sort of, you know, satanic rag, you're probably smart enough to realize that $15 million, even $35 million from this country in this cause is embarrassing and not only stingy, it's shameful. We're going to be back with Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, to talk about the pharmaceutical industry after this. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of Air America Radio.
50 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My co-host Mark Riley still on vacation in England. He's really on vacation. Don't worry. He will be back. England has a habit of swallowing people up. He used to be on this show. But he will be back on Wednesday. I hope he's having a good time. I'm sure he is. We got on Monday, Wayne Gelman's going to be co-hosting.
Good morning. I'm Wayne Gilman.
You guys are going to need like an extra hour for that show.
No,
pauses.
Yeah, that's what Renee said. Renee said the one funny thing she ever said. Because you were talking about our booker, Renee. Because Bashman brought up having the guitar player, the lead singer of Fish come on. And she's like, I hate hippies kind of person.
Right.
And I, of course, have you know, a sort of soft spot in my heart because I have a little hippie inside. You know, I was, I've been to two Grateful Dead shows, and I lived with deadheads in college. But so I go, the only way you can come on is if he plays. And she's like, oh, no, the show might, you know, you might have to add an extra hour to the show or something. Anyways, that laugh is Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, who is going to be here in a reporting mode.
Hi.
We talk to you a lot when we have you in when we discuss tort reform and the pharmaceutical industry. What is your background with that, Dan?
Well,
you worked for who?
I worked for the Chicago Medical Society for about a year and a half in Chicago. It's an organization of doctors. It's kind of like a city version of the American Medical Association, like a more local level of that. It's like the doctor's version of a bar association.
Because you get worked up about a lot of things, but I know that tort reform and certainly this issue seems to have gotten you pretty excited.
Right, and what's interesting is that a year and a half working with doctors and of them hammering me over the head with their stance on these specific issues, I didn't have a strong viewpoint one way or the other when I started working there. I spent a year and a half working with all these doctors hammering me over the head with their points. And after a year and a half, I disagree with them on everything. So, I mean,
doctors are a little jaded. I grew up with one.
Yeah.
They're a little, they get a little, they get short focused.
Right.
They don't see the big picture.
Absolutely.
Certainly not investments. But that's my dad. Right. Anyways, go ahead.
Well, the point you just made, I want to bring up later when we have Dan Ziegert on in the 8 o'clock hour. But what I want to talk about now is this story in the Times today that links to a few other stories in recent days and in the last couple of years that I think is a huge issue that is not getting nearly enough attention. And that is, there are all these drugs out there today, these big prescription drugs that are blockbuster drugs. They make literally billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Billions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've all heard about what happened with Vioxx and Celebrex recently. They were taken.
These are drugs that, although they may do good things for you, they do worse things for you in the long run.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that for at least the last 2 years, long before this story about Vioxx broke, doctors at the Mayo Clinic, at the VA department, and at Kaiser Permanente have been sharply limiting their use of Vioxx and Celebrex,
mm-hmm.
not because they knew that they were going to cause heart attacks, but because they did their own independent studies on the drugs separate from the FDA, and they decided the drugs just don't really work.
So what does this imply to you, Dan Pashman?
What it implies to me is that the pharmaceutical industry, they put X amount of dollars into a drug to produce it, and at that point, it's like whether or not this thing really works. It's like, well, we already spent 2 years and $5 billion creating it.
And look at the name. It's a cool name.
Right. Who cares if it works? We got to sell it. It's
right.
Got to sell.
Right.
All right. One other great example of this is I pulled this article, I remember it off the top of my head, from December 2002, 2 years ago, about water pills. It says a new government-sponsored study suggests that old-fashioned, inexpensive diuretics are much more effective at treating high blood pressure than most of the newer, pricier drugs. It says researchers found the old-fashioned water pill, the kind your grandmother took years ago, works better than newer, fancier medications at reducing high blood pressure. Now, so not only are they ridiculously overpriced, these drugs, they don't even really work.
Right.
And the analogy I like to make is that these things are like boy bands.
Sure.
You know, it's
okay.
Like you take a mediocre teenager.
I said sure, like it made perfect sense to me, but I have no idea what you're going to say right now.
Well, okay, just stick with me here.
Okay. All right.
It's like you take a mediocre teenager and they figure, well, listen, we're going to dress him up in some stylish clothes. We'll teach him how to dance. We'll teach him we'll shove a few songs in his mouth.
Right.
Then we'll spend a few billion dollars on advertising, and we'll pay off radio stations to play his song so people can't get it out of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a hit.
Right.
You
and
know?
And what you, and I guess the analogy, if you want to take it a step further, is you don't realize at the time that it's actually bad for you.
Right.
and crappy. Even if it isn't bad for you, at least it certainly isn't good.
Well, this is sort of like, this follows along the lines of many of the tenets of modern capitalism, which is, it's sort of a planned obsolescence thing, which it doesn't matter. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. That doesn't make sense to the world of capitalism, is that, you know, if it ain't broke, why not make a new one that does kind of the same thing, that has a better name, and we can sell for more money because we can say it's better, right?
You're exactly right. What you just said ties in perfectly to one strategy the pharmaceutical industry uses to get around patent law, because once a patent runs out, people can start selling the generics.
Okay.
One thing that they do is they'll take a drug, and a year before the patent runs out, they'll release a new drug that's basically just a slightly amped up version of the old one.
Okay.
And they start pushing it on the doctors, and they start marketing it, and they try to get all the people on the one that's about to lose its patent switched over to the new one.
Right, so they can continue making money and get. Well, a lot of doctors are complicit in this. I mean, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of perks that can be made by doctors. It takes, you know, a pretty noble doc to do his own research to say that, look, you know, I remember having conversations with him. He's like, you know, why the hell would I do that? A lot of doctors, they develop a relationship with a drug that they know works.
Yeah.
And unless it's, you know, unless it's some sort of miracle drug that really proves to be more efficient, a lot of doctors, if they're good cats, will stick with what they know, because why would they want to put their patients through something they don't understand?
It's true, to a point, and I certainly don't want to fault all doctors, but I do believe that there is a problem that needs to be addressed with doctors. I mean, you talk about prescription drugs. Well, you know what? Whatever the pharmaceutical industry does, at the end of that chain, someone's got to write a prescription for that drug to sell.
Well, I'll tell you, doctors can be, I understand how they're corrupted now, because a lot of times within HMOs, doctors aren't enabled to do the best job that they can, because there are limitations within the HMO system for them to do the work that they want, to be good doctors, and they're not making the money they used to either. So if they're being bought out by pharmaceutical companies, I'm sure some of them justify it. It's like, you know what, if they're going to screw me, yeah, okay, sure, I'll go out to dinner, I'll take a trip with my family, I'll take a $30,000 kickback to use your drug, why not? You know, I mean, on some level, it takes a pretty noble guy to do medicine, because, you know, he believes in medicine and giving people, believes in the Hippocratic Oath.
That's true.
Thanks for sharing that stuff, Dan.
No problem.
Here's our liberal agenda for today from the Streisand compound. One, offer to be a designated driver, but only for registered Democrats. Two, at midnight, after yelling Happy New Year ad, though it will probably be our last due to the Bush administration's ongoing rape of the environment. That's always a fun thing at a party. Three, complain that college ball games are killing corporate sponsorship. Huh? Four, offer a prayer for world peace, a secular, gender-neutral, and racially nonspecific prayer to a deity unaffiliated with any particular religion, dogma, or system of beliefs. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation, quote, have you really looked at the lyrics to Auld Lang Syne, man? It's full of Masonic code. I'm not signing that, man. No way. Wake up, people. We're going to be back with Borzu Duragahi from Baghdad, I believe.
Yeah,
he's in Iraq.
And Rapture Watch as well.
All good. And Brendan P.W. McDonald, Kalo, Kent Jones, my wife might come by. Stay with us. 58 past the hour, Air America.
On Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Game over, man. Game over.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, you know, and all you people out there who are heading into the new year. Be careful, please. Try to have a happy new year. I know it's a tall order. We can all, you know, pretend like it's going to be a happy new year. On Saturday night, we can all do the best we can at going through the motions. But, you know, be grateful, you know, for what you have, and try to treat people differently in the new year, at least more generously, be less selfish, and try to help out where you can. If you want to help out more than the Bush administration is helping out, $35 million to the tsunami victims. That's the big pledge, $35 million. And this is the Iraq war costs the U.S. taxpayers $177 million a day. So if you want to help out and step up and do the right thing, you can go to morningsedition.com. We have a link there. We were just talking to Sean Bowen last hour. She was from the Red Cross. They need your help. So do that because, you know, if, as I said earlier, if I was a religious person, given that there are floods in Sedona, Arizona, there are tornadoes, you know, whipping across California and Colorado and Arizona, there are torrential downpours, there's a tsunami, I swear to God, I wouldn't be surprised if on Inauguration Day, you know, he comes out with epaulets and some sort of weird red crown and his eyes just light up red and go, our time is now. I completely prepared for that. Brendan P.W. McDonald is in the studio with me. Good morning.
Hello, sir.
Well, can I share my dream diary with you?
I hope you do.
All right, here we go. I haven't been to a therapist in 2 weeks. It's ridiculous. Here's my dream. It's New Year's Eve, and I'm in Paris with my dead cat Butch and the Four Strays, of course. It's a warm night full of stars, and we're sitting on the bank of the Seine watching spectacular fireworks go off over Notre Dame. We have a basket full of incredible cheese and grapes, and Butch is swigging from a bottle of Veuve Clicquot. I say, God, it's been an unbelievable year. Corruption and lies and war and sadness. Butch just swigs and burps and stares up at the fireworks and says, mm-hmm. I say, the worst people in the history of mankind are in power. Everyone seems afraid and hostile. Doesn't it feel hopeless sometimes? Butch nods and says, mm-hmm. I say, but isn't the world a horrible and depressing place? Don't you care? You're just going to sit there and drink and say, mm-hmm. Butch sighs and turns to you and goes, Mark Maron, where are you right now? I say, I'm sitting on the left bank watching the fireworks over Notre Dame. Butch says, do you think this moment will last forever? I say, no. I guess not. Butch says, which one of us is dead? I say, you are, Butch. Butch says, and which one of us is leaving? I say, I am, Butch. Butch says, so start acting like it. Have some foie gras. Rub my belly. So we sat quietly watching the fireworks and eating, and after a while we heard in the distance a crowd chanting, 3, 2, 1. Butch says, Happy New Year, Mark Maron. I scratch behind her ears and I say, Happy New Year, Butch. Then Butch got up, stretched, burped loudly and said, Come, comrades, let us go have 50 cat sex all night long and pass out in a gutter. The night is ours. I woke up and my bed was filled with liberty, equality, and fraternity. Butch.
Right? Butch? Those are very popular with the young kids, those dream diaries.
You know, we get the emails about Butch. They love the Butch. And I don't know who it is that's emailing or the age of them, but they like Butch. And I miss Butch. Oh, yeah. You know, Brendan, I don't know what you're thinking about doing for the new year, what your ritual is.
I don't really have one. I'm kind of like you. I heard you saying that before, that you're not really a New Year's Eve-y kind of guy.
Yeah.
But and I feel the same way. Actually, a lot of that stuff depresses me, Auld Lang Syne and those songs that they play. I just get a sense of melancholy around the new year.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. As I get older, and maybe it's always been, you know, I'm losing my ability. My defenses are breaking down, and I realize I'm outside of doing what I do as a comic or doing what I do as a radio performer. I am a fairly shy person, and I don't like crowds. I like a few people. So generally on New Year's, I'll try and find a couple of people and go somewhere where a lot of people aren't.
Right.
And just, you know, and just have dinner and kind of.
That's the best way to do it. You just celebrating with the people that are close to you.
I've been in that momentum before. I just remember, like, oddly, it's like a weird Bill Hicks story. You know, I remember, like, there's just always a panic. And I remember as a kid, this is not the Bill Hicks story, but when I was in high school, do you remember knowing, like, there was a party somewhere?
Right.
There was two or three parties, and you always had, like, a fragment of an address, and one guy always says he knows where it is. And, like, how many times when you were a kid were you in a car with three of your friends, you know, drinking, you know, beer in the car at midnight going, damn, I thought you said it was right here. Where is it?
Right.
And you pull up to a house, and there's no noise, there's no sounds, there's no party.
But the great realization is in knowing that you were actually having the party in that car. That was your New Year's.
Right.
Like, that you will have that memory more than you'll have the time that you went to the gala event with 500 people.
Yeah, because you get lost in it.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I remember Bill Hicks lived here. He was a comedian, for those of you who don't know. He lived in New York briefly, and I guess it was, man, I don't even remember what year that was. That must have been 1989. And I just remember it was New Year's Eve. We were at the Improv, which was on 44th Street, which is, at that time, was done. I mean, it was, it's a weird thing. That Bud Friedman, who owns most of the improvs, he started the nationwide chain, he had a wife named Silver, and they owned the original improv in New York, and Silver had that one. That was the only one she had. He couldn't open one in New York, but she had this old improv, which was this run-down little place with a lot of sad pictures on the wall. You know, great pictures of people from the history of comedy, but it just was run down, and it was kind of done. And I just remember sitting in there with Dan Vitale, who's another comic, and it was New Year's, and we knew just blocks away there were just thousands of people waiting for this ball to drop, and we were like, I'm not going. You know, I'm not going to go. You know, it's crazy. I don't want to do it. And then Hicks walks in, who just started living in New York. He's like, we got to go see the ball. And I'm like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, let's go. Yeah, this could be anybody, but it was Bill. So we left, and we hit this wall of people, and we saw some guy getting his ass kicked. I mean, just getting, you know, there were just like thousands of people, and just like people were gathered around. This fight was going on, and we couldn't get. Of course, you can't get anywhere near the ball. It's 11:45 at this point in time, and it's like it's coming up like it's like 5 till, and Hicks and everyone looks at me. We all look at each other. He's like, you know, this is crazy, man. Let's go back to the improv. So we went back, and there's like 12 people there. Like, yay, Happy New Year, New York, you know, and that was it.
But that was, I guarantee, Mark, that was more fun than getting pickpocketed and, like, vaguely looking at Dick Clark from the middle of Times Square.
Yeah, if you can even see him. Yeah. And who's doing it this year? Regis.
Regis.
Yes. I sometimes feel so detached from the momentum of culture. Is he there? Yeah, no, I don't know. Is he? Yeah, we got him. Well, do you want to take a... we have Borzudar Agahi on the phone right now from Baghdad, so we can get into some of these stories that are happening out there. Good morning, Borzu. How are you? Okay.
Yeah, I apologize. The connection's not great.
Okay, all right. Well, let's try to... I'll try and keep it as quick as possible here. So what is the effect that the Iraqi insurgents who lured police into a house packed with explosives, killing, seven policemen and 22 civilians, that must have a fairly profound symbolic effect on the momentum of the election and everything. Is it? Does it?
Momentum for the elections is pretty hampered already. But I would say that, you know, I went to the hospital where a lot of these victims were taken, and my translator went to the bombing scene. It's considered such a dangerous neighborhood that my driver and translator refused to the neighborhood, saying that it would all of us in danger. But what it really is just a totally, totally horrible thing. Iraqis now, you know, they're not even safe, you know, getting ready to go to bed in their own home. Which was the effect of this bombing, just really shattering the calm of everyday life in residential areas. Even if they're just stay out of everything and not have anything to do with it, you can get like some wacko moving to your neighborhood and, you know, blow everything up.
So what about the Sunni political faction removing itself from the electoral process? Initially my thought was a minority leaving out of protest. I don't know what impact, what is the designated, why are they doing it? What's the reason? What do they seek to achieve?
Politics there, you know, they've kind of withdrawn, like the Iraqi Islamic Party has kind of, they've withdrawn, but their name's still going to be on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late to remove it from the ballot. You know, and they're trying to, you know, if they do get a low vote later on, low turnout, if they don't get a great vote, they can always say, well, it's sad that, you know, we're not going to get a good vote, and et cetera. I think there's that political element there. I also think there's just a real sense of, alienation on the part of Iraq Sunni Arabs were dominant under Saddam and even under the Ottoman, you know, in the previous centuries.
Uh-huh.
And now they're about to be swarmed by the Kurds and the Shias. And, you know, there's going to be a real revolution in this country. And they feel like they're going to be at the bottom of the social order.
We're talking with Borzudar Agahi, who's one of our favorite journalists on the line, on a pretty shaky line out there in Baghdad. But Borzu, we had Mick Ware from Time Magazine in here just a little while ago, and he said something very interesting when Mark Riley asked him, are people in Iraq, are they going to welcome this electoral process? He said, short answer is no. And I'm reading an article today with from the AP saying that, quoting people in Iraq, saying we're not used to the democratic process. Is that true, the feeling that you're feeling out on the streets there?
makes a friend, actually. I don't know if I would maybe disagree with him on on whether people are looking forward to it or not. I think a lot of people are looking forward to it as a novelty to some extent. It's just a new thing. It's an interesting thing for them. You know, it's really true because Iraqis are not used to ticket splitting or, you know, researching a candidate or, you know, looking up a candidate's position, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They just vote for, you know, the big strong guy, whether that's like the big strong guy of their tribe or the big strong guy of their faith or the, you know, or Saddam was many years. That's what they're used to. They're not used to this idea of like, you know, you vote for a candidate because you think he'll be good in the mix of the political spectrum.
Okay.
You know, in Iraq, you vote for a candidate because you think he's strong.
Right. Well, Borzu, you know, this connection's a little rough. We appreciate the information. We have a couple more questions. Maybe Pashman can get on the line and see if he can get on another line. But if not, it was great talking to you. Have a happy new year. It's 18 past the hour. We'll be back in a second on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Tim Robbins. It's time to wake up with Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
We're fighting for our lives here.
Past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. Mark Riley on vacation in England until next Wednesday. Monday, Wayne Gelman co-hosting. Tuesday, Anthony LePay from GNN going to be co-hosting in the studio with me now. Our associate producer, Brendan P.W. McDonald. Also, before we move on through this, please, if you want to give anything, to donate clothing or money, go to morningsedition.com. We have links there for tsunami relief efforts. They need everything that they can get from regular decent people, given that our government has only pledged $35 million. Brendan, so we talked to Borzu. We tried to talk to Borzu.
And thanks a lot to Borzu for getting through to us. It was a tough hope getting him on the line all morning. So thanks, even though it was a shaky connection, thanks for him finally getting through to us.
Well, the frightening news, you know, out of Iraq as we see building is that, you know, not only is bin Laden aligning himself or allowing al-Zarqawi to align himself with bin Laden's cause. Now, al-Zarqawi has been a very sort of, you know, efficient evil bastard in terms of executing terror. And there's now a political alignment, a symbolic alignment between, you know, the old al-Qaeda and, you know, the new insurgency. And you have these Baathists within the insurgency that, you know, and now you have the Sunnis, you know, pulling out of the electoral process. You know, it seems to me that it's on the verge of some sort of civil war.
And what we are noticing, too, is an insurgency that is becoming crafty and downright organizational.
Yes.
As an operation. This thing with calling police officers to a building on a tip, a false tip that there are insurgents in there, and then blowing up the building with civilians inside, I might add, is horrendous stuff. I mean, this is a different kind of enemy that they're dealing with over there than even that they've been dealing with for the first year and a half of the occupation.
Absolutely. And what we've been seeing also is that these are guerrilla tactics. You know, there was always this thought that, you know, this insurgency would, you know, either dissipate or become immobilized. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, in a guerrilla warfare, you know, there's no end to it, because they have figured out a way. That a few weeks ago, there was a release from a military spokesman that said they are getting more, you know, efficient, more deliberate, and more scheming. I mean, they were able to pull off several different, you know, events, you know, in the last 3 days, at the same time, give or take, you know, they were clearly synchronizing what they were trying to do. And their attacks are, not only are they evil and dangerous and killing civilians, but they are symbolic in that they are putting a message out to regular Iraqis that if you align yourself with the Americans, there will be a price to pay, you know, in the future.
Well, and at least Colin Powell now agrees with you that this insurgency isn't ending and that there's no end in sight to it, although quite a policy shift from what our government has initially been saying. And this is just something we've been noticing going on throughout the last 3 years, that the rhetoric on this evolves at the whim of the government based on what perception they want to give with the actions that they're taking. Osama bin Laden, wanted dead or alive in September of 2001. And then in March of 2002, when it was pretty clear that the guy was lost in a cave somewhere and was evading us, here's Bush's quote: "I don't know where he is, I have no idea, and I really don't care. It's not that important." And then just a few months later, "The war on terror is bigger than one man."
Right.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing how they, it's not even, this isn't even blame dispersal. This is just some sort of strange kind of rationalization, a propaganda rationalization that for people who aren't engaged in this, and a lot of people in this country, you know, we'll talk about that in the next segment, the Frank Rich piece about detachment.
Right.
In this country has really shifted, you know, because, you know, the popularity of this war is waning for people who once believed in it and for people who once even, you know, supported the effort because it's become what? It's become clear that the troops aren't being supported properly.
But I think I've always talked to you about this, that people, all they need is to hear that they just needed to hear when we were going in to invade Iraq that we would be welcome with open arms. They just needed to hear that from someone in order to rationalize why we were going there.
And that Iraq were terrorists.
Right. Just like they needed to hear, we're going to win the war on terror.
Yeah.
Then later, which was changed to, I don't think you can win it. You can just hope to control it. And then the same thing with Colin Powell saying just 4 months ago, this insurgency will be brought under control. It is not an impossible task. That's a quote. And then we get this week, this insurgency will not end. These insurgents are determined to have no representative government. They are just generating these buzz phrases to go along with whatever is the inevitable action that's going to be taken over there now.
And they're counting on the American population's denial and detachment and selfishness to keep up with this, you know, this, these lies and to keep, you know, destroying, you know, this country and also bankrupting our country. It's a lot to think about in the New York. Thanks for that, Brendan. We'll be back. It's 28 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Edition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley, my co-host, is still on vacation, the lucky stiff. On vacation in England.
Is there a Riley Town in England?
I think there's a Riley Town everywhere. You could just bring Riley Town with you.
That's I've train missed to, Riley Town, man. We haven't had enough moments.
I know. I don't know. I thought we had some Riley sounds in here. I don't know where they are, though. I don't. Because, you know, he's got those signature little thing. Do one, Brendan.
Yeah.
He'll be back.
Incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're talking about New Year's. Obviously, we're talking about also, you know, I think the greatest service you can do to yourself and to the people around you is to be a little more selfless, if possible. And obviously, there is a horrendous disaster in the world right now with this tsunami. We had Sean Bowen on earlier. She's a spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross. We put links to her organizations or to where she's recommending you can go on our website, morningsedition.com. So please, I mean, donate something. It's very easy to feel powerless and detached from the things in the world because on some level we are. Our only source of information a lot of times is what comes through our computer, what comes through our television sets. It's really hard to even fathom, you know, 100 people dying, let alone close to 100,000. And it's necessary that people help out because our president, you know, until we hear otherwise, is really just, he's like, it's almost as if he pulled out his wallet and said, let me see what I got here. Well, I haven't gone to the bank, but, you know, here's $35 million, you know, which is crazy. And he's got, when's the inauguration, Brendan?
January 20th.
So he's got a little time to step up and do the right thing around this issue. I really think that, you know, we need to give more money. He needs to be a little more empathetic.
Right.
And instead
$50 million being spent on the inauguration, which I think would, you know, be a magnificent gesture to spend that money otherwise.
Yeah, that'd be amazing if that happened.
Right.
He just said, "Look, the inauguration. We're just going to have a quiet family dinner. We'll have my father videotape it, and we'll try and get it on the news."
Right. Well, he's got 3 weeks. We'll see if he does the right thing.
Yeah, or just maybe It's just disappointing. It's disappointing to see that right out of the gate, all they could do is criticize Bill Clinton for being, you know, in front of the cameras
first, you know, when he actually, that was on Tuesday. You know, this thing went down on Sunday, you know, American time.
Yeah, Clinton gave him some time.
Yeah, I mean, he had 2 days, for, you know, and then what they said about Clinton just saying, look, you know, he's a showboat, basically. You know, he just stole camera time. You know, we are at least are going to be able to do something about it. Criticizing him for being empathetic. You know, and condescending, saying, you know, we just didn't want to have that kind of like, you know, I feel your pain moment. Right. Why not?
Well, it's almost a cliche that they always go back to beat that horse. I mean, that's what Rush Limbaugh has made a career in doing, in that anything, it can he will draw it back to the fact that there is a visceral hatred of Bill Clinton and the policies that he stood for. So it makes it, it's an easy out for them and to and a way to appeal to their base.
But the selfishness, right?
Sure.
The selfishness in the face of the biggest natural disaster of my life. You know, that all he can do in the moment of where, you know, an empathy, you know, needs to be so large to accommodate the type of grief that the world's going through. The first thing that the Bush administration does is take a shot at Clinton for being an American diplomat at the right time.
It was interesting that Frank Rich in today's New York Times pointed out that bubble that a lot of Washingtonians live in. I think he was using it directly to illustrate the what was going on at the Kennedy Center honors,
yeah.
Right? And that... you know, it was big pomp and gallantry there. A lot of kind of Hollywood light, which is usually what the Kennedy Center's honors is. It's like an Oscar pre-show. And just how disconnected that is with real Americans, with what's really going on right now. And that's what we saw with the tsunami. And I would venture to say even to pull Clinton into that. We heard from Samantha Power yesterday, who is someone who has been in Darfur and been through a lot of studies of genocide, and she brought up that point that in during the Bosnian genocide, the only thing that finally made Bill Clinton act on that was that he realized he was getting killed in the press.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's this, a similar disconnect, and I mean, we're just seeing it very much more rapidly here with Bush, in that it's only happened within a few days. We can already spot that disconnect between he and what's going on in the global politic, and how other nations were much more on the ball with getting a message out there and sending adequate relief.
Yeah, and forgiving debts almost immediately.
Right,
Germany,
we have not said that we're going to do that. They asked him that during the press briefing yesterday, and it was a real hem and haw and roundabout answer, the same as when they unfortunately asked him if he knew anything about tsunami warnings, and it was a real stumble bum. Like,
yeah.
Him saying, I'm not a geologist, so I don't know that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, he is incapable of true empathy, as is, you know, Rumsfeld and clearly Cheney and all of them. They pay lip service to things, and they do this tough love number, but truly incapable of any sort of real, you know, empathy or compassion, you know, on a global level, you know, because they play to people that are ignorant and condescending, and on some level, you know, there's people in this country saying, who cares about those people? And those people should be ashamed of themselves, the people that think that way. Right now, we're going to make a little shift here into our interpretation of old radio. I'd like to present the first installation of Morning Sedition Radio Theater. After this, we're going to come back with Rapture Watch with Mort Milfington, so stick around after this. Here's Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Deep in Washington, D.C. is an entity that has the amazing ability to cloud citizens' minds. What evil lurks in the heart of this shadow government? Only Mark Maron knows.
It was Thursday, and hotter than Fallujah during a napalm drop. I was working a special prosecutor beat out of D.C. when in walked a dame with a body that had so many curves it made me believe in the single bullet theory. Even the scales of justice statue peeped out from behind her blindfold.
Are you Mark Maron?
Whatever it says on the door, Toots.
It says janitor's closet.
Oh, right. I've been meaning to change that. So spit it, honey. What's the scoop? Give me the lowdown. What's a Jane like you need a gumshoe for? You looking for a Jasper, a Johnny, somebody in Dutch, somebody dust out on you?
Huh? I need you to find a missing person for me.
Right. Park it, dollface, and fill me in.
I don't know whether you've noticed, but people have been disappearing out of President Bush's cabinet. His Secretary of Agriculture, his Secretary of Homeland Security, his Attorney General. Something very strange and terrible is happening in Washington.
So what else is new?
One of the people who vanished used to be Secretary of State, but he's still my husband. I want you to find him.
Oh,
you must be Mrs. Colin Powell.
They told me you were good. Will you help me?
Usually I don't get involved with married dames, but this one had something special. Enough money to pay me a salary for the first time in a while. So I headed out for a little nose-to-nose with the president's press secretary. He wasn't squealing.
I got nothing to say to you, Marin. Tougher guys than you have tried to get me to talk.
I'll bet you Helen Thomas never asked you this. Maybe that'll make you think twice about pulling a gat on me.
That doesn't even hurt.
Oh, yeah? Well, does this hurt?
I have no comment at this time.
That's when I felt someone sat me in the back of the noggin and I dove into a black, inky pit. That last thing I heard was McClellan saying they were at the Manitoba site. When I came to, that's where I headed. I heard rumors for years about a secret government site in Manitoba for government bigwigs that had gone screwy. After a couple of hours of driving, I heard it. There was no mistaking it. It sounded like someone strangling a canary.
Like she's never soared before.
I headed toward that voice, which was one of the hardest things I've ever done. There they were, banded like Democratic voters at an Ohio polling place, living in some kind of hippie commune. Former Education Secretary Rob Page. Former Agricultural Secretary Ann Veneman. Former Commerce Secretary Don Evans. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge. And the songbird himself, John Ashcroft. But no Colin Powell. They were suspicious and eyeing me like a hanging chad, especially Ridge.
Who are you? What do you want? Would you please take off your shoes and empty your pockets of metal objects?
The name is Marin, and I'm looking for Colin Powell. Where is he? What happened in Washington? Is that a loom? How about you, Ashcroft? Spill it.
It wasn't supposed to turn out like this. Bush went crazy. Once we found out the truth, our lives weren't worth a dime. Washington was too hot for us.
Keep your mouth shut, Ashcroft. You're putting us all in danger.
The truth about what?
What else? Bush and Bin Laden.
Zip it, you crazy broad.
Where's Powell?
He went back in. He said he was going to bring in Bin Laden himself and blow this whole thing sky high, even if they take him out.
Who are they?
The shadow government. That's who.
That's when I heard the shot. Black Ops. They were circling the farm, getting ready to land. I'd been tailed. The cabinet members scrammed into the woods. I was right behind them when the chopper started squirting metal. My head was spinning like a Bush press release, but I wasn't going back empty-handed. Somewhere out there was a terrorist mastermind and a president who knew too much and wasn't talking. Or maybe he didn't know anything, and he still wasn't talking. Or maybe he did. Man, I'm tired. I think I got jet lag.
Can Mark find the missing four-star general? Can a four-star general find Bin Laden? Does Bush already know where both of them are? And how did Mark get jet lag when he drove? Find out next time on The Shadow Government.
I'm Reverend Al Sharpton, and I may not be part of his diocese, but I listen to MILF Cardinal Milfington's Rapture Watch on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Fifty past the hour, you're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. Mark Riley is on vacation in England. Wow. That was weird. I kind of locked. I had a brain skid. The Bible's book of Revelation portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Janesville, Wisconsin. Your Grace.
Heed my clarion call, ye blaspheming phlegmatists. Kneeling at the altar of Satan's jewel-encrusted phallus, look to the heavens, thy vexed kissers of salamanders and people who dress ducks up in little tuxedos and top hats. Take notice, ye gluttonous imbibers of tasteless salt beef, wormy hardtack, and the occasional rancid lemon peel. All right, guys, I told you a million times. Do not mix my list of hedonizing foodstuffs with my list of things people had to eat on medieval sailing ships. The two are completely different. Team Milfington does not have to be from Harvard, you know. I can always get Tulane again next semester. Anyway, three hebdomads ago, I told you about a dog driving a truck through the front window of an auto parts store. The week after that, I told you about a man accused of using the postal service to mail dead birds and rats to some guy. And the week after that, I told you about a man on eBay who sold 2 tablespoons of water purportedly taken from a plastic cup Elvis used 27 years ago. Not only is that idolatry, but the damn stuff tastes like asparagus. I think I got the wrong kind of water. Enjoy your dead birds and rats, jerk. Now, I know a lot of you gods besmirching humanists thought I was going to talk about that disaster in Krakatoa or whatever. Well, sorry, I'm not. Not enough white people.
Oh, no.
Today, I've got something more important to talk about. That's right, standardized driver's licenses. President Bush just signed a bill requiring the DMV and the Department of Transportation to set uniform security standards like holograms and magnetic strips for driver's IDs within 18 months.
Uh-huh.
Isn't any coincidence that when you combine the digits 1 and 8 from the number 18, they add up to 9?
Uh-huh.
And when you turn the 9 upside down and we reverse it, it becomes a 6? And when you take 3 doses of peyote and run naked in the desert, it becomes 666? Are you with me on this? It's the mark of Satan! For it was prophesied in Revelation
96 tears.
The Antichrist will cause all people to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads or on that little area on the lower back where some women like to put tattoos of butterflies. Cannot stop running naked in desert. Okasa shintasa opasa shunda muntata. Oh, man, that's good rapture. Anywho, these new licenses will allow officials to monitor every movement you make. Hey, I don't want the government to know I never leave my Barca lounger with built-in refrigerator and catheter.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's right. Now I know what you're thinking. On the one hand, it's a bad thing because it's the mark of Satan. But on the other, it's a good thing because it's bringing about the rapture. Good or bad, bad or good, I simply can't decide. Too hard. Shunda muntata kasita muntata satata bumchaka. Burp, Grandpa Joe, it'll make you sink. Good or bad thing. Hell if I know, man. I'm just a messenger of God. And you know what? Right now he's saying, oh, yeah, good rapture. So keep running naked in the desert, fornicators, and we'll keep the light on for you. In hell.
Oh, man. Oh, you're all right, dude.
Yeah. I'm fine.
Nothing about the tsunamis, though, no?
Tsunamis I will not talk about, though. You know why?
Why?
Not enough white people.
All right. So what about the inauguration? You think that might be part of the whole thing?
A part of what thing? You're rambling now. You know, I said this before, and I'll say it again. I've been following your career for years. Best toupee in the business.
Oh, wait a minute.
Man, it looks like you got a dead possum on your head.
Oh, come on. You've seen... That's not a toupee. Why do you say that, Rev? Why? Why are you bitter? What happened to you? You know what?
I guess I hate myself.
Oh, God. Whatever.
Whatever. Dead air.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. That was a pregnant pause meant for punctuation. All right, Reverend Milfington.
That's Cardinal Milfington.
I'm sorry, Cardinal. I apologize.
Cardinal Milfington, as the Reverend Al said.
Yeah, okay, buddy. Thanks for coming by. It's always a pleasure.
See you in court.
Yeah. So that was I'm baffled.
The Cardinal's problem.
I know he did. So Brendan P.W. McDonald's here. Kent the Colonel Jones is here. My wife, Mishna Wolf, stops by. That's very nice. Good morning, Mishna Wolf.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. I haven't seen you awake in, a couple of days. So let's talk about movies, because it is the new year. I have seen a lot of movies. I know, Kent, you go see a lot of movies.
I try.
The one I want to talk about, because you guys haven't seen it yet, is that one that we got, what was that disc we got, In Good Company?
with Dennis Quaid, then Topes of Grace. Now, maybe because I'm getting older, maybe I'm becoming a softie, but I thought it was a sweet little movie that it dealt with mildly dark subject matter about aging, about younger people coming into jobs, about people's parents and whatnot. And I thought it was very touching. I thought Randy Quaid was brilliant.
Dennis Quaid. Well, the guy who made that made About a Boy, and that was a really competent movie, I thought. It was good.
This is a pretty small film, though, in a way.
Yeah, but here's... Okay.
What? Go ahead. Talk.
It's just like that movie just didn't, it just didn't really come together. It was like just a series of folk songs.
So we got thumbs up, thumbs down over here? Is that what's going
on?
It
was just like, I don't understand. I don't understand the use of folk songs in this movie.
You're just bumming out on the little emo acoustic music.
It's not just that, though. It's like, it doesn't make you an art film,
Right.
And it was like this weird, I couldn't even tell what the movie was about.
Yeah, but it was sweet. I thought it was touching. Yeah, that's what I thought. What do you got, Ken?
I enjoyed the trailer.
Yeah. What did you see lately?
I haven't seen it. I saw The Life Aquatic recently.
Oh, yeah.
A little disappointing, only because I really like Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I'll have to say that from the outset. It was like somebody invited you over to this house, and he has this very large toy box, and he says, let's look at all my toys. And after about 45 minutes, I was like, okay. Senior toys. What are we doing?
That's a good analogy.
Let's do something. Now.
Yeah.
You have interesting toys. Can we have a story and some characters and plot and?
Yeah, but he has really interesting toys. Because we saw it the other night. My first response, because I knew how you felt before I went in, and I thought the narrative was a little. I got a little bored. Mm-hmm. I dozed a little bit. But the interesting thing to me was it's really like going into a store that sells antique, music boxes. Is that he's so ornate in his framing that he puts a lot of work and a lot of effort into composition and the film movement. And, and it is pretty spectacular. It's the kind of thing I think that will, over time, people will return back to. I think this is a guy that has not yet made his best movie. I think he's a very talented guy. Yes. And
he could do worse than attaching himself with Bill Murray, too. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Angelica Houston and Cate Blanchett and good cast.
But it was a little peculiar, but I think I need to see it again, actually.
Yeah.
So we'll be back. Misha's going to hang out. We're going to talk to Ron Ziegart about the economy, Social Security, tort reform. It's going to be exciting. All right, so come back. We're listening to Air America Together.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. Cat lovers, Happy New Year to you people. I don't know if happy is the right word, but in the sense that, there are a lot of horrendous things going on in the world right now, as you all know. If you want to get involved with tsunami relief, you want to find a resource or a place where you can send money or clothing, we have a link at morningsedition.com. Early on, we had Sean Bowen on the show from the First Aid and in International Red Cross in Geneva, and she set us up with some websites, so you can go there. And I urge you to do so, because I think George Bush basically, when asked for money, said, "Let me see what I got in my wallet. Yeah, I gotta get to the bank, but I can give you I'll give you what I got in here, but we'll see if he steps up and gives more later. I don't know, but there are resources there, so go and check that out. Mark Riley, if you don't know, is on vacation in England. We'll be back next Wednesday. Monday, Wayne Gilman. Will be co-hosting with me, which I'm looking forward to. Because, I got Kent Jones, Kent the Colonel Jones, here by my side. I got Mishna Wolf, my wife and comedian, further down, who is now mad at me because Kalo, who's on the board, had to bring something up.
I'm very sorry.
No, I mean, you couldn't know. But apparently, I said something about my wife that I thought was true, but now I'm the ass because I didn't know.
It's just not true.
Okay, fine. You're not a jealous person. You never get possessive of me. You don't get, it doesn't even run through your head. My mistake. But where was I going with that? I was on the path.
There's no
what
problem
I,
here.
But I was
wait,
just,
wait, wait, wait.
I was just
can
talking
we just back
about
up about this, okay? When I first started going out with Mark, seven times a day he'd call. Seven times a day.
How is that unusual? I work at home. You know, I mean, come on, you know.
When I started, when comedy wasn't going well, and I had to get a day job,
mm-hmm.
he'd call me at work.
Yeah.
Seven times.
What did he say?
What are you doing?
He's like, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Okay, I'm here. I'm working on some stuff. I'm kind of, I don't know what I'm.
Oh,
good.
All right. So
I mean,
wait.
Like, I'm kind of in the middle of some things. So, can I wrap this up and call you back and be like, sure, but...
Yeah. No, you can't call me back. So it's cat's out of the bag, I guess. I'm needy. Did you know that, Kent? Did you know that about me?
It's fine. It's all fine. There's nothing wrong with calling seven times. Well, maybe there is.
Tell him about the...
This is going to
tell him about the...
a little pain at the end of the year.
Not guy with the jealous wife. Why don't you tell him about the inscription you put in your book to my friend Richard?
Oh, okay. All right. Now, look, this guy, her friend, Richard, who, like, all I hear about
he's
is
not
like,
even my friend. He's like a friend of a friend. He's in my clique.
That's even worse.
But he's, okay, but look. But
I mean, he's my friend.
All right, so how much are you going to rationalize this? Let me just say one thing. All right, here's what you do. Like, you know, I say, who is this guy? And here's what she does. He's a fan of yours. Oh, okay. Well, I guess you should have sex with him then. I mean, what is that? But the thing is like, this is a guy that every time I talk to him, we live on different coasts, so it's hard enough, Ken,
yes.
The way it is. And I go, well, what are you doing tonight? Well, me and Richard. Well, then what are you doing tomorrow? Well, Richard's going to, and what about this weekend? Richard, and then when you start to get jealous, here's what I get. Me and Richard and other people. The qualifier, the other people. So I met this guy, and you know, he's a nice guy. He's a comedy writer. He's a smart guy. Big fan of mine, all right? And he wanted to... So Mishnah wanted to get him to get my book, so I gave him my book, The Jerusalem Syndrome, and I signed it to him, and I said, don't think I don't know what's going on with you and my wife. All right? Just watch it, basically, is what I said, right? And I signed it.
Right. And there's...
In blood?
There's... There's clearly nothing... going on.
Well, you don't got to take a shot at Richard, but I mean, Richard. I mean, you know, the guy's a good guy. I thought he was a friend of yours.
No, but I'm in a male-dominated business. You know that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in comedy. When I met you, I was hanging out with male comics all day, every day.
You
know, it's just my
can
world.
I be honest with you? Baby?
Yeah. Imagine the smell.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I'm sorry you have to be in the middle of this.
You kind of brought it up with the jealousy thing.
Yeah,
like,
I know you're not.
Because I'm not really jealous.
This always happens at the holidays. Can't we get along?
Yeah, I know. I'll be honest with you. I'm sitting there last night with you. I am so grateful that you're in my life at all. It's, you know, and I have no, I'm not jealous, really. The only thing that I resent is not being able to spend more time with you. I don't really fester about that stuff anymore. I just don't. And that's the truth. And I know you're not jealous. And what me and Chris were talking about yesterday was not so much jealousy as it was that, you know, when you say something that could promote insecurity, not necessarily jealousy. It's just sort of like, you know, I know there are certain actresses that you hate only because, you know, you think that, you know, people like them or that I might like them.
Like
or,
who?
That English woman, Knightley. What's her name?
Keira Knightley?
Yeah. I mean, why do you hate her so much? Why? Because she's pretty? What? Because, you
no,
know,
because
I one time said I thought she was attractive. What?
She's definitely an attractive girl.
Okay.
I don't like her for other reasons.
Like what? Why don't we share about this a little bit?
Okay, because I don't feel like I've ever seen her act.
Oh, okay. So.
Like, I mean,
all right.
She's been loitering in front of the camera.
She's just sort of there being cute.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I understand. But I'm going to get to the heart of this, though, because I think that sometimes, like, if I were to say some sort of general thing about, you know, like, about women.
She's
like,
got no nads. Okay?
She didn't bring it. She's got no edge. But if I were to say some general thing about women, like, you know, like, I was observing lately that, you know, it's very rare that a woman has a perfect body. You know, would that on some level, and of course that's all.
No, I would get mad at you for being so critical of women's figures.
Well, wait, how long would it take for you to say, you don't like my body? I mean, how long would it really take? Like an hour, 6 hours, what?
I'm very happy with my body.
Oh man, I thought we were going to get to some truth here, but apparently you're putting on a little show. I'm sorry, Kent. Are you okay, Kent?
Can we talk about
I'm very happy with...
Can we talk about tort reform? Can we please talk about tort reform? Because this is making me...
Uncomfortable? No,
yeah.
I'm kidding. You know, you're
not...
Knightley uncomfortable or just regular uncomfortable?
You're like Kate Beckinsale uncomfortable.
What are we, so New
it's
Year's...
It's just ineffectual British girls.
I
For some
you.
Reason, I find them insipid. They don't really like...
Right.
They don't really do... I mean, it's like, okay, you're talking, you're looking at the camera, you're sullen, I can see you're sullen. Now you're thinking about something, but you can't really articulate it. You have no words.
Yes.
You want to scream, but you can't let it out because you're completely ineffectual.
Okay, I understand. Now, let's talk about The Office, because Misha and I sat through the entire second season of The Office,
yes.
The British TV series.
Yes.
Speaking, and I'm not a British comedy guy, but this thing, it really, like
amazing.
Last night, I realized,
it's so funny.
He's a genius.
Oh,
the guy's a genius.
It's spectacular.
And
yeah.
They're making an American version of it, because I read for
yes.
it, and there's no way it's going to work. You know why? Because American, you know, television audiences will not be able to even register what is funny about that, because it is so uncomfortable. It makes you so uncomfortable, and that's part of the whole, you know, greatness of the
yes.
humor there. And I swear to God, I could see regular, you know, people who are not, you know, who can't register that as funny would just be like, this is horrible. This is awkward. But
yeah,
that is the whole thing.
I have a tough time imagining American TV executives really getting into the idea of an office environment, too. Really being able to get it.
Well, they tried that with that work with the Dana Gould thing. What was that called?
Yeah.
You remember it was on for about six... Working, it was called.
Working.
But this thing is so...
The office is amazing.
It's really unbelievable. And why do I advertise for this? But it was one of those moments where I generally first react to things like that.
Ricky Gervais, he's a genius.
He's a genius. I didn't realize how good that girl that plays Dawn is.
Oh, amazing.
She's really great.
Well, they're great. So after this, we're going to move on. We are going to talk to Dan Ziegart, writer and investigative journalist, who recently wrote The Right Wing's Drive for Tort Reform for the Nation. He's also the author of Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry. We're going to talk to him a bit about Social Security, about tort reform, about economic issues that face this corrupt administration in the next year. Thanks, Kent, for dropping by.
Hey, Mark,
Happy New Year, Mark.
I'm grateful for you every day, too.
Oh, that's very sweet. I love you. Now we're going to have a fight. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour. I am Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley on vacation until next Wednesday. The lucky stiff. 2 weeks he's got. Someone on the blog said that I don't even know what they said. Something about soccer. I thought I had it in my head. It went away. Arsenal won. So I wonder if Riley got tickets for that. If he did, we'll hear about it.
Let's hope he did.
Yeah, Monday, Wayne Gelman and myself will be here. He'll be co-hosting. That's going to be great because, you know, none of us really know Wayne.
I know. I can't wait to get – what makes Wayne Gelman tick?
Yeah, that's Dan Passman, son of Lewis and Linda Passman in New Jersey. It's going to be really interesting because it's going to be like me interviewing Wayne Gelman for 3 hours.
Seriously.
Right? You know, he's got – every once in a while he'll come in here and him and Riley have an exchange and be like, oh, my God, Wayne Gelman has this secret life.
Cracking open a door and a ray of light shines through it.
Full of opinions and weirdness. Yeah,
dude, I get to spend 3 hours a day with him in the newsroom picking his brain.
Do you pick his brain?
Oh, sometimes,
you know
sure.
More? All right,
well,
let's do this. This came in from Ramon wearing a cowboy hat and little else this morning, and the temperature was kind of odd. Here is George W. Bush's Palm Pilot. Here's the president's schedule for today. 8 a.m., wake up in Crawford. Note, I'm fat, fat, fat. Get on that bike, lard ass. 8:10 a.m. Ride mountain bike hard until sense of panic and shame subside, or until I fall off. 11 a.m. Make emergency announcement to the world. We must raise more money in this critical time. $50 million for my inauguration will not be enough. Do you know how much buffalo wings cost? 1 p.m. Go to coffee shop. Note, make jokes with locals about Asia throwing a little bit of that tsunami our way. Let's get kind of dry out here. Then tell the one about the black, the Mexican, the Jew, and the rowboat. Brutal. 3 p.m. Respond to AARP attack on my plan to privatize Social Security. Arrest everyone in local Applebee's during early bird special. 5 p.m. Prepare for New Year's Eve. Note, plan to go to bed early. The world expects me to be on vacation. I can't disappoint them. 7 p.m. Resolution for 2005. Same... Oh, different year. Let me try that again. Same... Different year. I'm sorry. You know, I forget. Very privileged to have our next guest. We talked to him on the phone, had a great conversation with him. He's the author, he's a writer and investigative journalist. He recently wrote The Right Wing's Drive for Tort Reform for the Nation. He's the author of Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry. He is with us now, Dan Ziegart. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here because, you know, this stuff fascinates me and I never feel like I know enough about it. Now, I read a Krugman piece not too long ago that says that, Social Security is really fine. Mm-hmm. So why does the government depict it like it's, you know, falling apart?
Well, because George Bush has a habit of governing by crisis, as you may have noticed. And that's kind of interesting because it's really a totalitarian trait. I mean, if you look at some of the you know, great totalitarian dictators of history, that's how they govern. Caesar did it. Hitler did it. The Reichstag fire, you know, that was a crisis.
To create a crisis.
So when you don't have consensus, when you're trying to fix something that doesn't need to be fixed, like Social Security or the civil justice system, what you do is you say there's a crisis.
Right.
And that kind of suspends the rules, and then you don't have to really fully make the case.
So they do this on all levels. Then they do this. I mean, with just like even recently, I realized that you know the terror alert, the terror threat, the every that whole sort of mode of panic that led up to the election has dissipated.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, this year's weapons of mass destruction are going to be two things. They're going to be Social Security and they're going to be, quote-unquote, tort reform, or what I call victims' rights restrictions.
Right.
And any time they do that, they depend on 20 years' worth of ill will that they've developed towards liberals.
Okay.
And that's all by way of, you know, what they call dehumanizing the opposition, which they've gone a long way towards doing. If you can sell a book on the bestseller list called How to Talk to a Liberal, as though it was a dog.
Right.
Well, then you've really gone a long way towards, you know, making your opposition into something that doesn't count anymore.
Why can't people see that they're being, you know, they're being manipulated? Why can't people see that they are, that the policies that they want to put in place will hurt them?
Well, I think there's one word that explains a lot of things that have gone on over the last two or three years, and it's called Fox.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a little outlet of the right wing in your living room and it's on most of the day, that's really going to have an effect on your thinking.
Yeah.
And as I've sort of traveled around talking to people, the one thing that keeps coming up is Fox.
Okay.
I think if Air America was on television, we'd have a much better shot at making the national conversation a lot more intelligent.
But don't you find that it's easier for these people? For some reason, the thing that irritates me is that to be conservative, narrow-minded, and simple in your understanding of things, and if there's hate there as well, it's a lot easier than being embracing and tolerant and trying to understand other people's point of view.
Well, I mean, hate is a powerful worldview, you know. I mean, hate is a fully integrating worldview. It allows you to bring everything together.
Okay.
You don't have to explain, you know, press that button, diddly.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about Social Security for a minute.
Right.
In that, a lot of people are saying that it's not really a privatizing. It's not the element is they're not privatizing it. What they're doing is basically spending they're taking people's money and putting on something that that could fall apart.
What it is it's basically sort of what happened with the savings and loans, right? Back in the 80s, you take the people's money, you know, in this case, money that people have been, you know, putting aside for many years, and you give it to the private sector. You just give it to them.
Right.
That's what's going on. It's quite simple.
Okay.
You know? Yeah, so you're privatizing it in the sense that you're removing it from private people, you know, and you're giving it to the financial industry. It really hasn't earned our trust, if I might, you know, if I might point that out.
Yeah, and so basically they're taking protected money and making it
unprotected. Right. Exactly. Right.
We're talking to Dan Ziegart, writer and investigative journalist. Dan, I want to tie two of the points you just made together. You talk about the effort to dehumanize liberals and dehumanize the left. And we're moving into this Social Security discussion. One of my concerns for the Democratic Party in the big picture and specifically on this issue of Social Security is the lack of an alternative.
Right.
Our people just seem to be saying, no, the right is wrong. What they're saying is wrong. Now, say what you will about the right wing's plans to privatize Social Security, they're horribly destructive, but at least they have visionary ideas.
Right, exactly.
Where are our visionary ideas?
That's a damn good question. I mean, I think the one of the big problems that came out was not that Kerry had nothing to say, but he had no language to say it in. He had no vocabulary. Any time he tried to use a word, it had been appropriated by the other side. And what these guys learned was, where their playbook came from? It came from us. It came from the people in the 60s. That's how the conservatives Republicans went from being, you know, a minute fraction of the Republican Party to controlling the Republican Party 30 years later. That's what we have to do. The first thing you have to do is energize your strongest people.
Right.
And in our case, that's the left. The Democratic Party's strongest people in terms of the people who have ideas, the people who have something to say, and that actually represent the soul of the Democratic Party is the progressive wing of the party. And the more the Democrats try and go out and act like, you know, faux Republicans, Republicans light.
Right.
The less they're going to be able to accomplish.
Well, let's talk about some of those ideas when we come back. I'm looking forward to doing that. We're talking to Dan Ziegart. I'm here with Dan Pashman. You're listening to Air America. It's 28 past the hour.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. I am Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley on vacation until next Wednesday. We'll be talking here with Dan Ziegart in just a second. I'm with Dan Pashman, son of Louis Lyndon Pashman in New Jersey, is
yo.
In the room. I just want to take this quick call. We haven't had a lot of calls today. Ted in Nebraska, how are you?
Good morning, Mark. I'm not surprised the liberals against tort reform.
Yeah.
You people always have your hands out.
No,
it's always
okay.
Something for nothing in liberal land. When do I get my money? That's always what it's about.
Oh, it's happening. Oh, no, I hate when it's... Help me, Riley. Oh, my God. Oh, no, it's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
Now, Pennsylvania.
And now, live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservatives' way to wake up. With Mark the Shark Maron.
Good morning, neocon. It's 20 after the hour here on Radio Halliburton. Halliburton got freedom. We do. The New Year's coming, and oh my God, oh, there's a little bubbly for you. I love to pop my cork. Protect your eyes, liberals. So Bill Clinton is shooting his mouth off, saying Uncle Sam should take the lead in providing aid for the so-called tsunami victims. Oh, boo-hoo, my country's underwater. Give me all your money. Hey, Billary, what would you do? Oh, whoa, Bubba. Can't you keep anything in your pants? Hey, I'm not surprised Clinton's all worked up over this. He likes anything wet. Am I right? Am I right? Hey, Asia, here's some aid for you, courtesy of Mark the Shark. Yeah, there you go. Now shut up. Hey, W's inauguration is coming up. Mandate. And it's going to cost $50 million. He'll double it, triple it, I say. Who are we going to give that money to? The greatest president who ever lived. Right, or a bunch of soggy curry slurpers. Right, wrong answer. Case closed. Hey, it's 22 after the hour. Let's take a call. You're on the air, caller.
Oh, those damn liberals, feminazis.
Yeah, that's right. Right you are, caller. Global warming is a crock. Hillary Clinton's the coldest place on earth. I hear Bill's got frostbite on his... Oh, hey, it's 24 after the hour. Time for the neocon power weather forecast. It's cool and dry here, not like some places. We win again! USA! 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 All right, stick around, neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Don't touch that dial, Patriot. We'll be back with Right and Early.
Oh, man. Oh, God. Dude, what happened, man? I blacked out again.
That was freaky, man.
Yeah, dude, I hate when that happens, man. All right, so we're back with Dan Ziegart. Sorry about that, man. It's okay. I have these weird fits occasionally.
I was just waiting for a relative of yours to walk in and to take over for me.
All right, so let's talk about where we are. Let me just give you the proper introduction. Dan Ziegart is he's a writer, investigative journalist. He wrote The Right Wing's Drive for Tort Reform for the Nation, and he's also the author of Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry. Now, let's talk about reframing a little bit, because when we talked to you on the phone, we actually lifted that thing, restricting victims' rights, which I think is a great way to talk about
what they're calling tort reform. So what's some other things that we can do to reframe the language?
Well, I mean, you know, you talk about, if you're going to talk about, you know, solutions, and everybody wants to talk about, well, how are we going to solve this problem? How are we going to solve that problem? Well, let's have our own solutions that are actually progressive solutions.
Okay.
It's not just a matter of the language. That's an important one. But if you want to talk about, let's say, malpractice or something, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so how are you going to fix, you know, malpractice? Malpractice means people are making mistakes in medicine. It means people are getting hurt, okay? So let's have a solution for that that makes sense in the context of, you know, people really being seriously injured. These guys want to make it easier for doctors to get injured. Why don't we come back and say, okay, you don't want to have a civil justice system take care of it? Those people could be criminally prosecuted. Let's see how the doctors like that.
Right.
I mean, so that's a real alternative. It's not just John Kerry trying to say, well, let me see here. I'm not really sure what I'm going to say about this. I'm not really for tort reform. On the other hand, you know, I don't want to pretend that I'm pro-lawyer. Okay? So, I mean, it's not just a matter of language. It's also a matter of, you know, we need to have actual progressive, you know, answers for some of these questions, you know?
You know, Dan, I think one of the problems that we've been running into is, and I was just thinking about this yesterday, is that a lot of people, a lot of liberals have fallen into this trap of thinking, oh man, the Clinton years were such a huge success that if we can just get back to that, everything will be wonderful again. People don't seem to comprehend that the Clinton years were the aberration.
Right.
All right, we go back to JFK being shot. Clinton is the only success story we've got.
Right.
All right. And this problem is so much bigger and so much deeper.
Right.
It's
a success story, but remember that he spent several of those years defending himself against allegations of, you know, having sex.
Right.
And still a success story.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I think people don't realize how deep the problems go with
right.
the way we address our issues and the way we fight for what we believe in.
Right. Right.
But what Dan was used to, what you were saying before too, is also that there, you know, it should not be this weird attempt to move towards a center that doesn't exist. There are democratic principles that have to be upheld.
Right, right. That's what I'm saying. That's
yeah.
the core of it. The core of it is, you know, are we going to identify something that works for most of the people in this country, or are we going to try to be Republicans light? That's what I'm saying. We can talk about what the insurance industry does to people. If they want to talk about lawyers, we can talk about the insurance companies. We can talk about how they're picking people's pockets every day. We can talk about why is it it's the law in all 50 states, or pretty much, that you have to have this kind of insurance, that kind of insurance. You know, where did that come from?
Right.
You know what? We want to know where that came from? That came from the insurance lobby. It's not some magic that you have to have insurance for all these different things, like cars, okay? There's a reason for that. So, you know, if you're actually going to have a conversation about issues, you have to have something to say.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys have had 30 years of framing the issues. They've had 30 years of developing what I call these think tanks, okay? They're not real think tanks.
Right.
Cato,
Heritage,
thank you.
The
Manhattan
Propaganda Institute.
They're stink tanks,
yeah.
All right? They put out a pervasive conservative odor for very little intellectual output, okay?
Yeah.
They're not really working on issues. They're working on disenfranchising people.
Absolutely. And
go ahead.
Well, I just feel like, you know, the one thing that we need to emphasize in this is that when you go to some of these core issues, some of these red meat issues that the pundits will have you believe are tearing America in half in favor of the right, the fact is that most of these issues, people agree with us.
Right.
All right? People agree with us, the majority, on abortion. People agree with us on more spending for education.
Right.
All right? On tax cuts for the wealthy. They already agree with us.
Right.
And it's such a serious problem that we can't make them see that we're on their side.
Right. But for 9/11, John Kerry is president. Okay?
That's
but
true.
For 9/11.
Yeah.
So let's not throw out the Democratic Party because we lost an election.
And he wasn't even necessarily the best we had.
No, he wasn't necessarily the best we had.
That's true.
There may not have been a best.
Right.
I mean, that's true, but I feel like 9/11 or no 9/11, George W. Bush is one of the worst presidents in our country's history, easily in the last 100 years. And the fact that we could not crush him in this election is really an indictment of the leadership of the Democratic Party.
Right. It's not that hard to come up with some of the things that Democrats stand for. All you have to do is search your memory. Okay? We stand for, you know, employment. And not just quote-unquote full employment, because Jesse Jackson has a great line about that. He says, under slavery, we had full employment,
yeah.
but no benefits.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's not just a matter of full employment. You don't have to think very hard to remember what Democrats are about. But you do have to go back to previous. You mentioned the Clinton years as this great success. The Clinton years were all about pulling the party to the right.
Yeah.
Right. The Democratic Leadership Council.
Well, let's talk about how they sort of they threw this wrench into the machinery with their what they call moral issues, but are really, you know, their human rights and civil rights issues that they use to sort of fragment, you know, what used to be the Democratic base. And we can do that after we come back. We're talking to
Dan Ziegart. It's 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion.
Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of Air America Radio.
Okay, I guess we're going to try and land this thing for the last time this year. We're here with Dan Ziegart. He's the writer and an investigative journalist. He recently wrote The Right Wing's Drive for Tort Reform for the Nation. His book is Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry. We were going to address some wedge issues, but I think it's more important that we get into, you know, the article and the truth about what tort reform means, because they're blowing a lot of smoke, and none of it is based on reality. Very little of it. In terms of how much malpractice costs, you know, what malpractice suits really, what is their, the damage that they reap on the system? It's 1%, right, Dan?
Yeah. I mean, the actual cost of, you know, all of the liability to the medical establishment is less than 1%. Okay, so yeah. That's not what's driving the cost of healthcare.
Right.
It's not even lawsuits and healthcare. Let's remember, is more than just the cost of malpractice insurance. Okay,
much more,
much more, because malpractice insurance is a very small cost. So you have sort of within malpractice insurance, do lawsuits drive it? The answer is no. Within a health cost, does malpractice insurance, the cost of that, the cost of doctors protecting themselves from lawsuits, does that drive the cost of medical, of delivering medical service? The answer is no. Okay? The thing is here that, you know, you have an ability here for the right wing to come in and basically change the civil justice system, which is a huge thorn in the side of all companies, okay? I mean, malpractice is only one part of a much bigger picture, which involves our ability to go into court and stand toe-to-toe with a big company that poisoned our well, that, you know, made a Celexa or a Celebra, whatever that stuff is, mm-hmm. that they're about to...
Celebrex.
Thank you. Celebrex. They're about to... One of the four or five that they're going to be pulling in the next couple of years.
Right.
Okay? So there's a whole raft of things that are involved in the civil justice system. Okay? It's not just medical malpractice. And this is you were talking wedge. This is the wedge for all those other things, so that they can bring within their umbrella the entire civil justice, basically throw it out the window. And this is a unique thing. The Seventh Amendment of the United States guarantees our rights of civil trial for all matters over $20, okay?
Mm-hmm.
$20 at that time in the 18th century was how much it cost to buy land, okay? So that's why that's there.
God, if only I invested then.
Yeah. You see what I'm saying?
You blew it, Marin.
You could have owned Massachusetts. Think about it. But, okay, so you know, you've got the Seventh Amendment. Why are we slaving, you know, to the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. right? I mean, everybody wants to be strict constructionists on the Second Amendment and quote it, you know, and say, No, take out the militias. We're talking about guns here. Okay.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment guarantees our right to a civil trial. What does that do for us? It means that, you know, in the United States, uniquely, we can go into court and make a company produce documents and tell us why they did what they did and prove it and get damages and get punitive damages, which means that a jury can tell the company, you screwed up, you did something criminal, we're going to sock you with a big amount of money, which is basically a civil fine.
Right.
It's the only place in the world where we can do that. Okay.
Right, and you can, and that effect of that would actually be to punish a company, maybe make them change their policy
right.
or their manufacturing behavior.
That's exactly right.
Right.
That's the idea. In other countries, now, why don't they do that in other countries? All right, I'll wrap this up very quickly, which is a very simple reason. We don't have much of a social welfare state here. We have a very thin social welfare state. In countries like Japan, France, Germany, et cetera, most of the rest of the industrialized world, what these people have is they have medical insurance. It covers them from cradle to grave. Okay. If you're injured, then the government comes in and takes care of you. We don't have that here. So we depend much more on an entrepreneurial system, right? The American way, you know, free enterprise.
Sure.
That's what lawyers are, remember?
Right.
They come in. They're actually business people, right? That's why they need to make money. That's why if you cap their fees, they can't do their job anymore. I mean, isn't that the American way? Or did I miss something here?
Why
are conservatives arguing against... You know, arguing to change the Constitution. Ask yourself that.
Totally. And I think in general, whether it's the strict construction.
Wait a minute. Didn't you used to work for the Chicago Medical Association?
I did.
Aren't you really the enemy? And you're sitting right across the desk from me here.
Hey, fellas.
Okay. Get back.
I was the bioterrorism project coordinator.
Wait.
You better watch out, man.
What does that mean?
So let me understand something, Dan. In terms of what you're saying is that if this stuff goes through, if the tort reform happens, that means that there will be a cap on the amount of money that people can get in a lawsuit against a corporation, which means a corporation that is doing bad business, that is hurting people or hurting the environment, can now write that liability into their bottom line and continue the behavior that they're doing, you know, almost without penalty.
Correct. Right.
Okay.
What it enables them to do is do the math, okay? I mean, if you're Ford and you make the Pinto, right, it costs you $5 to put that extra seal on the back that would have prevented the explosion from happening, which
yes.
they knew in advance. This is the best known example of this. That's why I'm using it. Okay? If you already know what your maximum exposure is, you just do the math. Okay? You know that, you know, it could be $40 million from lawsuits, or it could be $50 million from putting the extra $5 seal. And you know what? They make these choices every day.
Yeah.
It may not always be that crass, but one thing I've discovered from about 20 years of doing this is they always know, or almost always know, before the product goes to market that there's something wrong with it. Let's not forget that these guys do a lot of testing. They do a lot of, you know, all kinds of...
a lot of this?
A lot of...
Or more of a throwing of the dice.
Yeah, it's more a dice sound.
Yeah,
do you have a dice sound?
I wish
there?
We did. I'll get one.
Yeah.
But I think what you're really saying, basically, Dan, is that until it gets to a point in a given industry or with a given product that it costs them money
right.
to produce faulty products or to hurt people,
right.
they're just going to keep doing it.
Let me give you a really good example.
All right.
Does anyone remember asbestos?
Okay. Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, asbestos wasn't pulled from the market because the Environmental Protection Agency said, hey, this is bad stuff. Even though hundreds of thousands of people had gotten sick and tens of thousands had been killed, it was pulled from the market because of lawsuits. To this day, the EPA hasn't banned it, okay? And that's because they tried and the court said they couldn't do it. They said they didn't have the authority to do it. So you want to talk about pulling lawsuits? Let's think about things that would still be in our environment. Things like asbestos, we wouldn't have seat belts, you know, a lot of things. The world before product liability suits was a pretty dangerous place.
Yeah. Well, where are the good guys? Just tell me this, a yes or no. Is there any momentum on behalf of good lawyers, you know, decent doctors, people within the health profession, within the law profession, within the corporate world that are in support of not doing this tort reform?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
But we have to have coalitions. It can't just be the lawyers.
Is there a resource we can send people to?
Yes, you should send people, I hate to say this, but you should send people to Public Citizen. You've got to drop your anger against Ralph on this issue. Okay.
Yeah.
Because Public Citizen is bringing together the lawyers with labor and all the other people who are really going to be hurt. All of us regular folks are going to be hurt if we can't go to court and take on the big guys.
We'll put that on morningsedition.com as a link to Public Citizen. Dan Ziegart, really appreciate you being here. We're going to have you back in the new year, if that's
Thank
okay
you,
with you.
That sounds great.
I love talking to you. Dan Cashman, let's reflect. Mishnah, why don't you come back in here and, you know, let's what are you going to do for the new year, Dan?
I'm going to go to a party with one of our coworkers here at Air America, throwing a party in Brooklyn. I actually, this may surprise you, Maren, I'm kind of a minimalist on New Year's Eve.
You are.
I do not, one of Cashman's rules is don't try too hard to have a good time on New Year's Eve.
I just pulled back because you don't want to get your expectations too high. And I think
exactly.
This is an important year to reflect and really see what we got to do in terms of the next year. Like I'm saying, for myself, I just want to, you know, not be, you know, so self-involved and try to treat people a little better, like my wife, who is mad at me for being a boy's boy. All right, what are you going to do? What are your plans for your New Year's resolutions, baby?
I'm going to quit smoking.
No,
that's a good one. That's a very good one.
Yeah.
Mishnah's here in support of the orange revolution in the Ukraine.
Absolutely.
Okay, she's wearing all orange. She's
Yushchenko.
All orange.
Stuff.
Viktor Yushchenko would be proud.
I love him.
Yeah. So, Dan, you're still here, Dan Ziegart. even though we said goodbye.
Mike has been turned off.
Right, even though we said goodbye.
But I am still here.
What do you think people need to do for the new year? I mean, and progressives. I mean, because clearly it's hard to think that everything's going to be good or everything's going to be happy. I mean, certainly in our own worlds we can feel grateful. But, I mean, what do you think of the progressives need to be thinking about for the new year?
They should remember Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize. Let's stop whining. Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about how well the right wing does everything. They learned it from us. Okay?
They appropriated everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And guys, this is Brendan in the booth. I just want to say the new year, we all should look forward to some big stuff from Air America too, because we're on the map and we're really going to bring it in 05.
Go team!
And with that, we also should expect a fax machine right about now.
It's amazing the timing of that fax from the Streisand compound. Here's the liberal agenda for today, our last show of the year. Here we go. One, offer to be a designated driver, but only for registered Democrats. Two, at midnight, after yelling Happy New Year, we'll probably be our last due to the Bush administration's ongoing
ongoing rape of the environment. That's always going to be fun for the party. Three, complain that college bowl games are killing corporate sponsorship.
Zing!
Four, Yahtzee. Four, offer a prayer for world peace, a secular, gender-neutral, and racially non-specific prayer to a deity unaffiliated with any particular religion, dogma, or systems of beliefs. Choose your own. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Have you really looked at the lyrics to Auld Lang Syne? Man, it's full of Masonic code. I'm not singing that, buddy. No way. Wake up. How clear does it have to be? Happy New Year, people. Be careful. And do, I'll see you in a few days. I'll talk to you then. Take it easy. This is Air America Radio.